You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. So, confession time. In nearly 15 years of living in LA, I have never, ever been to the La Brea Tar Pits or its museum. And, you know, like a mastodon mired in a lake of tar, I just haven't made it out. But I'm taking the plunge today because the La Brea Tar Pits, as you know them, will be changing. The grounds in the museum, like its neighbor, LACMA, will be undergoing a big reimagining and expansion. Back in 2019, architectural design firm Weiss Manfredi from New York won that competition to undertake this mammoth feat. And the museum folks even reached out to you for some input as well. I'm here in the main science lab of the museum. And Dr. Lori Bettison Varga, she's the president and director of the Natural History Museums, because there's more than one, of LA County, which oversees the La Brea Tar Pits. Hi there.
Hi.
I'm a tar pits newbie, right? So you have to tell me, what are the tar pits? I mean, for someone who's never been to LA or someone who's never been here but has lived in LA for a long time, what are the tar pits?
The tar pits are asphaltic deposits that have captured in time the most recent climate change. So it really is the story of Ice Age Los Angeles from about 50,000 years ago to today. But more importantly, this is the only place like it in the world, and it is the largest collection of Ice Age fossils, Pleistocene fossils, anywhere.
Tell us what you're up to here and why the La Brea Tar Pits need to be reimagined.
Well, the museum here opened in the mid-70s, and not a lot has changed. It was really a place to display the finds here, which are incredible, and to inspire people to want to learn about Ice Age Los Angeles and these incredible, incredible animals that lived here. But we're not telling the story in a way that really connects it to today. And furthermore, real science happens here. And the collections and the lab work and the research needs to be better positioned for future work.
I mean, we're in the science lab.
We are in the science lab. We call it the Fishbowl. It is the original visible science lab. Yeah. A lot of museums, natural history museums, have these now, but they've come to look at our museum to see how it works.
So the reimagining, it's this New York firm that won the contest, right, called the La Brea Loops and Lenses. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, their vision is one that we really were seeking, which is to tie the outside, where the pits are, the excavation is, to the inside. So their loop is the loops and lenses approach is really meant to tie in not only the research in the pits that are over on the west side of the park, but also the civic space. This is a park. We want to make sure that we have space to engage the public in a variety of different ways, and you know, including our own festivals and activities, but community activities. And then the first part of the entryway really is meant to be kind of the pop culture in a way. Yeah. Our, you know, the wonderful mammoth and mastodon sculptures that we have that are in the lake pit, which is not a tar pit.
Yeah.
Okay,
but it's a lake.
It's a lake.
It's not a lake of tar.
It's not a lake of tar.
It's a lake of water.
It's groundwater with a lot of in it. It's
not.
It's got a lot of gunk in it, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Seepage of the asphalt, methane's bubbling up out of that. But that itself is not a tar pit. But entryway into the park in a more realistic way, tying in what's indoors with the outdoors and vice versa.
So this reimagining, right? You're going to build a bridge over this lake. Not the tar pit, but the lake with
The lake with
yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
The plan right now is in one of the loops and pathways is to have a bridge across there because it's an interesting spot to just sit and contemplate.
Yeah.
To think about what this area represents, the methane that's bubbling out. People love to watch the methane. Bubbles.
Yeah. It's like going to a geyser, right? And seeing like sort of Earth in action.
You know, I think that's right.
Yeah. When's this reimagining going to be done?
Do you have a crystal ball? Because I wish I had one.
Mine's broken.
Mine's broken too.
Yeah.
It's been broken for a long time.
So maybe within 5 years.
I hope so.
People will see the reimagined.
I hope so.
The reimagined La Brea Tar Pits.
Yeah.
asphalt pit. Lake with
Lake with.
Right? Oh, you're God. Never going to live that down.
I'm never going to live that down. Right? That is like, okay.
And it's okay. It's all right.
It's all right.
Because it explains it. Sometimes you just use noises to tell people what you mean, right? I think we can envision what is, right? It's just gunk like, and stuff. And
you don't want to swim in it.
You don't want to swim in it. Exactly. Dr. Lori Bettison Varga, president and director of the Natural History Museums of L.A. County, which oversees the La Brea Tar Pits, the pits of All right, and by the way, can we go see some of that?
Let's go. Let's go see Pit 91, and I can introduce you to a couple of our scientists.
Right on. All right. Out the door. Are we descending? Will we be descending?
Well, I think there's a ladder that we can...
Oh, I don't
sure
know if I'm cool with that.
Chance to get on. You get to do something that most people don't get to do.
So this is Pit 91.
This is Pit 91, yes.
And through the gate we go. Oh.
Right here.
That's really a pit. Ooh, and it smells.
Yes, it does.
What are we smelling?
Lots of gases.
Is this
methane?
Is this the
Benzene, sulfur.
Wow, that is a pungent smell.
I always forget the sulfur.
Oh my goodness.
Let me introduce you to our women-led team
hey.
Of scientists, Dr. Emily Lindsay.
Hey.
Hi, welcome to Pit 91.
Nice to meet you, Steve Chiatakis. And you?
And Dr. Reagan Dunn.
Hi.
Hello, welcome to the Tar Pits, our favorite place on Earth.
Right on. Dr. Emily Lindsay, thank you for, we're down in the pit. We're actually in the pit.
Yes, you're here in Pit 91.
In Pit 91. It smells every bit as what I would think it smells like, right?
Smells like science.
It smells like science. That's what it is. I guess my first question is how much is still left to discover here?
So here in this particular pit, we're about 15 feet down. We think we have about 5 feet more of deposit to go. And as you can see, there's plenty of fossils left to be discovered.
Just to, I guess, give you an idea of what it is that we're looking at. It's a square. We see, obviously, the asphalt and all the other gunk, tar, whatever it may be, right? And there are strings that's, I guess, make it a grid so you understand exactly where something's coming from and flags to mark things that are important.
That's right, yeah. So we actually started excavating this pit in 1915, and it was found to be a very large deposit with a lot of fossils in it. At the time, the Natural History Museum was sort of wrapping up their initial round of excavations, which were forming part of the founding collection of the Natural History Museum. They had plenty of fossils to display. They had a lot to do, so they decided to put this dig on hold, and then we reopened it in 1969 and have been excavating on and off since 1969.
What have you found in here?
So a lot of the classic La Brea fauna, plenty of saber-toothed cats, dire wolves, giant ground sloths, American lions, horses, bison, camels.
What makes this place, Emily, different from any other place? Like if you were to dig a pit and call it Pit 91 or Pit 93 in someone's backyard, what would be different about that pit than this pit?
So what's really unique about this site is that the substance that seeps out, asphalt, or what's colloquially called tar, is so sticky that anything that lands in there just gets stuck there forever. And the other really cool thing about the tar, the asphalt, is that it preserves a really wide range of materials. So we have, yes, bones of very large animals preserved here. We also have bones of teeny tiny animals like rodents and lizards. We also have things like leaves, seeds, and wood from plants. We also have remains of insects and snails. And it's very, very unusual to find any kind of fossil site where you get that whole range. And what that means is that as scientists, we can do types of analyses that are usually only possible in living ecosystems. So we can study the entire ecosystem the food web structure and even track it moving through time to look at how the different plants and animals living here were responding to past environmental changes like the end of the Ice Age, the arrival of humans, and the extinction of the vast majority of large mammals that were living here.
Dr. Regan Dunn, you do a lot of this as well. You're a paleobotanist, which includes what?
Paleobotany is the study of fossil plants. So while there's tons and tons of bones found here at the tar pits, there's also probably twice as many plant fossils than there are mammal fossils here.
Do you feel like people don't really know what's going on here? Like they see the outside, right? They see, oh look, there are the bones, there are the teeth, there are the jaws, there are the mammoths, and the ooze and the bubbling and all of that stuff. But like what the importance of this place?
Oh no, I live very close to here and people have lived less than a mile away from this site and don't even know that there's a museum here with fossils in it. So yeah, there is a lot to learn here. And one part of the ecosystems that we haven't really studied in a lot of detail, even in the over 100 years of research here, is the ancient plant life. And the ancient plant life tells us a lot about the environment that those animals lived in. And plants are really good indicators of what ancient climates were like. And so that's the best way to study ancient climates, is to look at the plants. And then to understand what happened to the animals, you have to understand what happened to the plants.
And then you look at those things and you can kind of get some perspective on what's happening right now.
Absolutely. And by looking at these recent time periods, these last 55,000 years that are considered recent in Earth history, really that's one of the most relevant times to study, to understand the human-caused changes that we're going to see and that we are seeing in our climate today.
Dr. Emily Lindsay, what does Pit 91 have to do with the reimagining? Is this going to be a big part of it?
Yeah, so in the current design, the idea is to have Pit 91 reimagined as an outdoor classroom space. So there would be theater seating all around, and we'd be able to have educational programming here so people could really have an even closer engagement with the excavation work that's going on and the type of discoveries that we're making here every day.
Soon to come, right? Here at the La Brea Tar Pits. I want to thank you both for bringing us down to Pit 91. Dr. Emily Lindsay, Associate Curator and Excavation Site Director. Dr. Regan Dunn, a paleobotanist and Assistant Curator here at the La Brea Tar Pits. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Steve. It was really fun having you out here today.
And there you go. My first ever trip to the La Brea Tar Pits. Wow, I learned a lot. And I'm so glad I finally saw all that history in our own greater LA backyard. I hope you'll check it out too. It's right there. Maybe you already have, or perhaps you've never been. Maybe you went on a field trip as a kid, or you take your kids there now, or plan to. There are some comments that we got when we asked for memories of the place, and here are just a handful of those.
Hi, I'm Lauren Valencia in Pasadena, California, and I was instantly taken back to a school field trip in the early 90s. We were by like the big tar pit and there were a bunch of birds. Kids were throwing crumbs for them to eat. And a friend of mine threw a grape and a bird went after it. We all looked at each other just shocked, and the bird caught it in midair, but on its way down and went into the tar. So it was like such a middle school moment where we were just shocked, embarrassed. We felt sad for the bird. It was so exciting for us coming from Whittier that day, taking the bus, going to Los Angeles, and learning about saber-toothed tigers and all of these amazing things in Los Angeles that came before us.
Anita Criticos emailed us, and she wrote, I grew up in L.A., loved going to the tar pits, and took friends and families there to see history. Or how about this story?
Hi, my name is Catherine McGraw. I live in Westchester, Los Angeles, and I have three kids, and we have been going to the La Brea Tar Pit since they were quite young. I think my favorite memory of going to the tar pit is when they were really little. As we were walking around outside, I would sort of randomly pretend to get my foot stuck in tar, and it would always kind of make them very excited. They thought that mommy was stuck, and then I would magically get my foot unstuck with their help. And I would do it again a few minutes later. And once they kind of caught on to this, then they would pretend to get stuck in the tar. And so we would just kind of walk around the grounds pretending to get ourselves stuck in tar and then getting ourselves unstuck. And there's just tons of laughter. They always thought it was fun. It's just a really magical experience.
Theodore Maya from LA wrote us and said, quote, I was mesmerized by the skeleton of a saber-toothed cat as a child. Watching my own kids react similarly decades later has been fantastic. Debbie Moore got back to us and she wrote, I haven't been to the La Brea Tar Pits for 60 plus years. I'd love to take my grandson, Vincent. He's 3.5 years old. Well, I hope you get back there, Debbie, and take that grandson too. Just a few of the comments and memories that we got about LA's La Brea Tar Pits. And thank you for responding. And deep appreciation for your support during KCRW's Season of Giving Back year-end fundraiser. We ended in high style and are ready for a new year of news, music, and culture. Your generosity helps fuel what we do. And no doubt there are challenges ahead next year, but we will meet those challenges and we'll keep informing you, entertaining you, connecting you to your friends and neighbors throughout Southern California because of people like you who listen and who join our membership ranks. You still have time if you didn't get a donation in. Go to kcrw.com/give. Coming up, one of the oldest Nutcracker performances around. In Long Beach, it's still going strong with so many people involved. You're going to hear about it after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Tis the season for the Sugar Plum Fairy and the Mouse King all dancing across the stage. It's the region's biggest performance of the Nutcracker put on by the Long Beach Ballet. This year there are more than 200 people in the cast, a flying sleigh and a full symphony orchestra, and it's their 40th anniversary. It all started with David Wilcox, who is the artistic director for the Long Beach Ballet, and he's with us right now. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. You were there from the get-go, weren't you? You started this.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. It's all my fault.
It's all your fault. So tell us more about the Long Beach Ballet first. How did it come to be?
Well, actually, there was already a ballet school here in Long Beach for 25 years before I took it over, and that was 42 years ago. And we took it over and we changed the name to Long Beach Ballet and started a professional company a couple years later. And so we started the Nutcracker in 1983. That was our premiere, and it was actually premiered at the Long Beach Terrace Theater. The sets were designed for that stage, and this will be our anniversary 40.
And it's one of the biggest here in Southern California, right? Here, at least in the greater LA region.
It's pretty big.
It's also very popular. So why did you decide to start putting on this show 40 years ago? What was it missing here in California?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was. Ballet West from Salt Lake City, Utah, used to perform down here with the Long Beach Symphony way before that. But then they stopped. And I actually got a call from the Terrace Theater saying, hey, you know what? You know, we understand we have a new ballet company in town. How would you like to come and do the Nutcracker here? So we did it, and it was a success. And then an opening opened up at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles, and they called me and said, hey, we understand there was a successful Nutcracker. You want to do it up here this year, too? So we actually performed it at the Terrace and the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion that year. And then we just kept going. It got really big. I mean, our biggest year, we sold actually 40,000 tickets, did 20 performances.
What's the difference between that show in 1983 and the one you're performing this year?
Well, it's kind of like the difference between my daughter when she was 4 years old, when she started ballet, and the way she is now at 26 playing the Sugar Plum Fairy.
She's in the show.
Yeah, she's in the show. She was a professional ballerina. She was in the Dresden Ballet in Germany for a while, but decided to come back to America. And now she teaches here at the school, and we'll be doing the Sugar Plum Fairy along with our prince. His name is Seth Orza, who's been our prince. He's a principal dancer from Pacific Northwest Ballet in Seattle. This will be his 11th year as the prince. He's wonderful.
And you have other family members in the show, right? You have other children in the show.
Yeah, that's a family affair, that's for sure. My my oldest daughter, Nicole, she was a ballet dancer, and then she went to school for stage management. She's our stage manager. She's been the stage manager for years. She could call this show in her sleep since she kind of grew up with it. And then my youngest daughter, Lindsay, she went to Berklee School of Music, and she's a flute player and a composer, and she's going to be in the orchestra. So we're all involved.
I read somewhere, David, that you said this is a performance for people who don't like the ballet. What do you mean by that?
Well, okay, my job is to entertain. I grew up in the theater, and my thing that I love to do more than anything, more than I love ballet, is I like to entertain people. So I want to make sure that when people come to see a ballet of ours, it is thoroughly entertaining, and it's not just for people who are just madly in love with ballet. I want them to be blown away by the scenery and the lighting and the special effects and the story and of course the music, right? Tchaikovsky's music, you know, can't beat it.
There are some other performances of the Nutcracker in Southern California as well. Is that what sets it apart, that there are so many elements to it and so many, as you said, stage cues and everything else, 200 member ensemble, all of that?
I guess that's what people tell me. I mean, I don't want to brag, but I mean, people tell me all the time that they've seen a dozen different Nutcrackers all over the country, and this is the best Nutcracker they've ever seen. As a matter of fact, we got voted most loved Nutcracker in the United States of America in 2018 and 2019 by Gold Star audience members.
That's very cool.
That's very cool. Yeah.
What do you do with that? Does that go on the playbill? I mean, what happens with that when somebody says you're the best Nutcracker in the whole country?
Well, you have to be careful when you say something like that, you know, because it sounds a little audacious. But we're very careful not to overplay what we've got. We advertise the fact that this is really put on by an academy with some paid guest artists coming in. But the caliber of the dancing and the students here at the school is so high that pretty much everybody who comes to see this production is convinced that it's a full professional company production. But it's not.
How do you get tickets to the show? Is it a tough find?
No, it's very easy. You can just type it. You can go online to longbeachnutcracker.com. And right when you go in longbeachnutcracker.com, there's a button, you click it, and it goes to Ticketmaster. And Ticketmaster, the tickets, it's really easy to choose tickets. And of course, the box office, you can save the Ticketmaster fee by going straight to the box office at the Long Beach Convention Center.
Well, it sounds fabulous. Obviously, a lot going on. And again, it runs from Friday night, the 16th, through Friday night, the 23rd. The Long Beach Ballet's show, The Nutcracker. David Wilcox, Artistic Director for the Long Beach Ballet. David, thank you.
Great pleasure. Thank you so much, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Next week on this program, to Van Nuys and the neighborhood around the local airport there and the environmental noise and smell concerns. That's next week on Greater LA. Check out the website at kcrw.com/GLA. While you're there, share your story with us. Tell us what's going on in your neighborhood. And of course, subscribe to the podcast as well at kcrw.com/GLA. Nihar Patel, Zeke Reed, Sonia Geis, Arnie Seipel, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help put the episode together this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time and attention. Have yourself a great night.